I'm Gary Knoll. This is the Progressive Commentary Hour. This is a program that takes on controversial, important, provocative topics, generally a single topic for the entire program. Today we are diverging from that. I had hoped earlier in the day that we would have a guest tonight. However, that did not come through. We will hope to reschedule that with Stephen and Jenkinson talking about the necessity for developing elderhood in a time of trouble. But what we do have, and I was going to be playing these over the next 2 days, is the first half of our program will be devoted to teaching. I've been a teacher for nearly 40 years in the college system. I've taught at the New School, the College of New Rochelle. I've taught at Pratt Institute, Fairleigh Dickinson University. And it's been a pleasure to be able to share insights with learners. I call them learners instead of students. More often than not, the vast majority have come into the classroom eager to learn new things. But before I teach them anything new, I try to impart to them the importance of critical thinking, to develop their skills and also to be able to differentiate between information that has not been vetted, that has not been verified, that may be biased, and in which case then, if they don't have those critical skills, they are susceptible to propaganda, to indoctrination, much like the citizens in Orwell's 1984. Well, in the 1960s, the mid-60s and 70s, millions of Americans protested. In part, we were able to protest because of our critical developmental skills. We were able to differentiate the nonsense coming out of the White House and other places from the reality of what it means to be a person who can stand back, assess something, and say this is right or wrong, positive or negative. And that's what we do. Today, almost all that has changed. And when I say changed, I mean really changed. In fact, this will be the first time in my adult life that I've chosen not to teach. I do teach, however, at our retreats and for small groups, in health support groups. That's teaching. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to begin by playing 3 separate video audio clips. And here's what they are. The first clip you're going to hear is a school teacher presenting her case of why she is resigning. She's not old. I'm guesstimating she's in her mid to late 30s. And she's been a teacher her adult life, but she now considers the classroom a battlefield. And she is a victim of that, as are all the employees in the school. She is pleading with the board to change the system. She says that every day kids come through the school, they bang on the doors, they sexually expose themselves, they will simulate sex on desks, they'll fight teachers, they'll hurt teachers, they're weaponized, and nothing is being done to stop this. Nothing. As if this is the new norm. Now, I'm not going to offer my opinion of what this woman says until later in the show. I am going to offer you an opportunity, because I know we have people in the school system listening. Is this the new norm? I would never see this in charter schools. It's never going to happen in homeschooling. And in some of the elite schools, the expensive schools, Dalton School and some of the others, you're not going to see this. But in public schools, yes. Now, once this begins to happen in one area, and this is Green Bay, Wisconsin, in a public school, then it spreads. So that's the first clip, and it's very important that we understand this. The mainstream media has not touched on this topic. The second clip right after that is something that, unless you were in the circle of identity politics, you probably missed because the media did not cover it. And that is a school, Evergreen School, a public college out on the West Coast, Northwest Coast. in Seattle, or the Washington State, they had a no white day, meaning no white students or faculty were allowed on campus, only blacks. And first, I couldn't imagine that would have been true. And because you cannot judge a student or a faculty member by the color of their skin, or we shouldn't, but rather the measure of their character. And it went south where teachers, and you'll hear this, teachers were actually kidnapped, physically kidnapped, and put into a room. They weren't even allowed to go to the bathroom unless they were escorted by one of these people that took over the campus. Also, the president of the university, as you can hear, he acquiesced to every demand they made. Now, one of the teachers who, he's your, you know, educated professor, Jewish and liberal, he didn't believe that this was that serious until they went after him, and he tried to explain that a university should be open to dialogue, conversation, a debate, in a civil manner. Well, that didn't happen. In fact, as you will hear, the police chief had to call him and say, I cannot guarantee your protection because the university president told us to stand down. So we can't help you, and there you're being hunted. Indeed, he had to flee because there was a group of people who were out to grab him. Now, what would they have done had they caught them? We do not know. As horrifying as that clip is, and the fact that it actually happened, he went before Congress and testified under oath about that experience and what it meant. But more importantly, that's the beginning. That's the canary in the coal mine. When the students take over a major institution of learning, higher education, and they control the administration, the management, all the teachers, the professors, and the student body. That's what I've been discussing. That's the danger of identity politics. And for those of us, myself included, who have spent countless hours helping learners, helping them to understand how to associate in life without prejudice and bias, how to be critical thinkers. This is the new norm? I believe it is. Again, I'm going to ask you, what is your solution? I'm interested in your solution. So I'm going to give you our talkback number so you can call in. Our number, I'll do it slowly. Write it down, please. 888-874-4888. Again, 888-874-4888. That'll be the first half of our program. For the second part, I have something different. So now we're going to go to clips. This is all about our educational system. It's about teaching. It's about the victimization of teachers who are not there to share their politics. They just want to teach. They want to help people learn and grow. They want to be a part of the important transitions in their lives, as historically teachers have been so instrumental in helping us. Now, to the first clip, this is a teacher at a meeting. If you're not able to see it, she's sitting at the end of a table, and this is the local board listening to what she has to say, none of whom are in her school.
I live at 563 Alro Street here in Green Bay. I have been a teacher in your district for the past 12 years. I came to work at Washington Middle School 9 years ago because I wanted to work with at-risk kids and kids in need. That is my calling in life. It's what I was made to do, and I'm good at it. I won the Golden Apple Award a few years ago, and I am consistently rated excellent by my administrators, supervisors, students, and parents. Teaching sixth grade reading at Washington was my dream job. I am here today because it is with great sadness that I inform you of my resignation from Green Bay Public Schools. Washington has been in a downward spiral for a long time, but has been deteriorating rapidly over the past 5 years, and rapidly during this school year. I fear for my safety every day. I am equally afraid for the safety of my colleagues and, most importantly, my students. We are in danger every day when we show up to our school. Students and staff are physically, verbally, emotionally, mentally, and sexually abused every single day in the building. This environment cannot be allowed to continue. Our students have the right to go to school and be safe, and your employees have the right to go to work and be safe. None of us are safe right now. We are sworn at and called vile, crude, and sexual names every day. I have a list here of horrifying things that were said to your employees and your students in just the last 2 days. It fills a page. I struggled with whether or not to read this list to you. In order for you to grasp the abuse we are experiencing, I wanted you to feel how we feel when these things are said to us. However, I couldn't bring myself to say them out loud because they are so disgusting. Ultimately, you have to know that these things are said to your employees and your children all day, every day. This constant verbal abuse takes a toll on our bodies and minds. It's devastating that I can't bring myself to say things out loud that I have to listen to day in and day out at my workplace. In addition to verbal abuse, the people at Washington are getting injured more than ever. I thought it would take someone getting seriously injured before necessary changes would happen. But then, just a couple weeks ago, a teacher was taken away in an ambulance with a bleeding head wound caused by a fight among three students. Another teacher was physically attacked by students trying to set off a deadly allergic reaction on purpose, causing her throat to close and her to struggle to breathe. A student was held down on a table and his legs put into vice grips so that other students could take his shoes. A student had his pants and underwear pulled down, exposing him in a crowded hallway of students. Another student approached a group of teachers and pulled his pants down and touched himself inappropriately while laughing at their request to stop. Male and female students this year are slapped on the buttocks, pitched in the chest, kicked in the groin. Just last week, two students laid on a table in the classroom and kissed each other heavily and pretended to have sex while a substitute teacher tried to get them to stop. All of those things I just mentioned happened in the month of May. I have a list that I will give to you of more. We've had fires set in the school, weapons brought in, drugs sold and used, and still it's not enough. Just last week, a student told multiple people, multiple times, that, quote, "I'm going to shoot up everyone in this school." Is it going to take someone getting killed for you to finally take the drastic action that is needed? Our district says that we value health and wellness, but our work environment has become so toxic, it is literally making us sick. I have numerous colleagues out on extended leave due to stress. It's a vicious cycle because we cannot get substitute teachers to come to our building. So every single day we are asked to cover the classes of our colleagues who are out. This perpetuates the cycle because we are thrown into classes with kids we don't know, sometimes with no lesson plans or rosters, given no support, and then have all our preparation time taken away from our own classes. This compounds the stress put on us and makes us even sicker. One of my colleagues has headaches every single weekday and is taking medication. Another one wakes up with cold night sweats several times a week. One had nightmares for days after being threatened by an aggressive student. Another person, one of my teachers, wakes up every single Sunday night around 2 a.m. and throws up in anticipation of the work week starting. We have heard of more teachers now than ever before being treated for anxiety, depression, stress, and the related health concerns that working at Washington brings. I comfort coworkers who are crying daily. We exhibit symptoms of PTSD because we live in trauma from 7:30 to 3 o'clock every single day. Just the other day, I broke down after I witnessed an 8th grade student in the office screaming and swearing at a staff member about his cell phone being taken away. This boy, was in my class in 6th grade. He had never been in any trouble. Never had an office referral, great student, polite young man, happy. But every day for the last 2.5 years, he has lived in the chaos that we adults have allowed to exist at his school. and he sees that the only way to survive in this environment is to be aggressive. He saw my jaw drop open at his behavior, and his face crumpled, and he started to cry instead of scream, because he is not this person. We created this person because of the environment we force him to be a part of day in and day out. Sadly, he's not the only child who has changed for the worse because of the education they are receiving at Washington. Their education teaches them the skills needed to survive in our school: swearing, screaming, skipping class, hurting people. That's the only way kids survive at Washington right now. Kids who do not learn these tactics are being tormented daily. I look out to the faces of students in my classroom and I see fear in their eyes. I have instructed my students not to answer the door to our classroom because of the truant students who run the school and come looking for fights. They pound on our doors, shake our door handles, scream swear words into our vents, punch and kick the doors, and terrorize us while we are trying to teach and learn. And these are just some of the many violent and aggressive behaviors that my kids have to deal with every day.
Now, if you're a privileged person, if you're going to a very exclusive school that costs a lot of money to get in, and some schools in New York City, private schools, can cost $50,000 or more per year just for tuition, even when they live in New York City and close to school. In those schools, you're not going to see that kind of behavior. But the public schools, for all intents and purposes, have been abandoned. And that's unfortunate. And they're being mismanaged. But what would you suggest? I'll share my thoughts after I hear yours. You can give a call now. Please call and share your solutions. 888-874-4888. 888-874-4888. Because this is a tough time to be a school teacher in public education. And it's also a tough time in colleges. Now, I never taught in high schools or junior highs or grade schools. But I'm also witnessing that in colleges, depending upon the college. Now we're going to go to a piece that I never thought, never in my imagination, would I see this happen in America. But it has. And now word spreads over the internet, and it emboldens people to say, well, if you did it, we can do it. Think of the consequences. Step back for a moment. This is not about ideology. It's not about it's not about whether you're conservative or liberal. This actually, the person you're going to hear is a liberal. We used to have a lot of liberals listen to Pacifica in our sister station in New York City, WBAI, where I've been 42 years. And when I asked, are you still listening, they would just shake their head no. I won't go into all the reasons why, but if you make an environment too uninviting, where you pride yourself on your identity politics to such an extreme that if a person is not in perfect alignment with those politics, you reject them. Somehow they don't meet your standards of purity. That's a danger, because people are not foolish. In time, they will find another outlet that they can harmonize with. Listen to this news broadcast and then see what you think of this.
Justice policies appear to be backfiring at Evergreen State College as that faculty continues supporting an openly anti-white agenda. But as one America's Pearson Sharp explains, students are not happy with what some say is the school's apparently racist policies, leading to a massive drop in enrollment.
Evergreen State College in Washington is making headlines again, but this time college officials won't be too pleased. The college, famous for hosting a No White People Day, is now staring down the barrel of a major funding shortage. It turns out white students resented being told they couldn't come to class that day, and enrollment at the school has plummeted. The school sent out a memo announcing it was expecting a 20% drop in new students this year, leading to a $6 million loss in funding. That's significant and is forcing the school to eliminate 24 faculty lines, as well as canceling openings for 19 vacant staff positions. Evergreen's chief of staff, John Carmichael, warned that another 20 staff members could also be let go, saying the layoffs are necessary to stabilize the school's budget. Many are pointing to the school's radical left-wing policies of banning white people from attending classes for an entire day as a major reason for the drop in new students. Last May, Evergreen took the unprecedented step of holding an official day of absence. It was intended to mark the contributions of Black members in the community, with students of color voluntarily remaining home to show how their loss would be felt. However, it took a darker turn for many, as Black and other students of color were allowed to attend classes, but white students and faculty were asked to remain home. While the decision wasn't officially mandatory, it was in practice, and when former professor Brett Weinstein decided to hold classes anyways, students threatened his life and began hunting for him on campus. Weinstein says threats of violence from Black students forced him to relocate his family in fear for their safety.
That the college descended into literal anarchy, and that for days the campus was not under the control of the state. It was under the control of protesters. That there were assaults, there were batteries, there was pressure not to report crimes to the police. People were, by the legal definition, I believe, kidnapped and imprisoned. That included faculty members and administrators. Others were hunted on the campus. That lawless bands roamed the campus unimpeded. Police were physically and intentionally blocked by protesters.
Other Black students held white faculty members hostage inside a classroom, even forcing them to ask permission just to use the restroom, when they would then be escorted by Black students to the restroom and back. Gangs of Black students gathered together in groups around the school, raising their fists and chanting Black Power, as well as other anti-white racist comments. Weinstein claimed there was a big difference between Black students choosing to remain home and white students and teachers being told they weren't allowed to come to school. Many have said the event is no different than segregation, and saying it's disgraceful for a public institution that accepts taxpayer money to hold these kinds of racist demonstrations. Nevertheless, Evergreen doubled down on its social justice efforts, holding yet another Blacks-only day of absence on May 16th, extending the event for a full 3 days. The event coincides with Harvard's recent decision to hold a No Whites Allowed graduation for Black students. Georgetown University followed suit, holding a forum on racism and excluding any white people from attending. One can imagine the response if Black people were excluded and only white students were allowed to attend a meeting about racism. However, as waves of students make their outrage felt by not enrolling in so-called progressive schools like Evergreen, perhaps other institutions will take note and avoid similar racist, segregated policies. But if white enrollment continues falling, colleges like Evergreen won't need to hold a day of absence because there won't be any white students left. Pearson Sharp, One America News.
Okay. Hard to imagine that that is happening in the United States. Hard to imagine what, if you were a faculty member, that you would think. How would you feel? Appreciated or denigrated? Once again, this is an environment where the students took over the university and controlled everything, including there's a video of this where they're holding the president in his office, or he's in the office with these demonstrators, and they're demanding things, and he's acquiescing and saying yes. That one professor was forced out of the university after his life was threatened. Now, the last part of this is this professor testified under oath in Washington, D.C. about his experience and what this taught him about what is happening now to the educational system in some colleges and universities in the United States.
And distinguished members of the committee, thank you for the invitation to address you. Tomorrow is the one-year anniversary of the day 50 Evergreen students that I had never met, disrupted my class, accusing me of racism and demanding my resignation. I tried to reason with them. I felt no fear because I knew that whatever my failings might be, bigotry was not among them. At that moment, I felt sure I could reach them. I also felt a moral obligation to try. That racism squanders human potential and erodes human dignity offends me. I am also well-versed in the evolutionary logic that makes racism durable. I should have had no trouble establishing common ground. Their response surprised me. It would take months for me to fully understand what had happened. The protesters had no apparent interest in the very dialogue they seemed to invite. I was even more surprised by the protesters' fervor in shouting down my actual students, some of whom had known me for years. The cruelty and derision reserved for students of color who spoke in my defense was particularly troubling. If not discussion, what did they want? I was one of Evergreen's most popular professors. I had Evergreen's version of tenure. Did they really think they could force my resignation based on a meritless accusation? They did think that, and they were right. What I had not counted on was their alliance with Evergreen's new president. Though the protesters openly humiliated him, the president of the college partnered with the mob in private, handing them concession after concession. We know this because the rioters filmed everything and proudly uploaded it. In one particularly telling video, the president calmly discusses with the leaders of the protest a demand to target STEM faculty based on the empty assertion that scientists are particularly prone to bias. In that same video, the president speaks of his plan for those who resist the new order. Bring them in, train them, and if it doesn't take, sanction them. He invites his partners to hold him to it. On the second day of unrest, the police chief called me. Rioters were stopping traffic and searching for someone car to car. The chief believed they were searching for me. She was worried for my safety and helpless to protect me, as the president had ordered her force to stand down. What would have transpired if the rioters had found me? I still don't know, and I strongly suspect they don't either. The protest at my class did not emerge out of the blue in May of 2017. 1 year earlier, I stood up and spoke in opposition to a dangerous proposal, one that threatened to establish a racial hierarchy amongst faculty. To those who have not faced something similar, this likely sounds hyperbolic. But one can now advance such policies and almost certainly succeed in passing them if they are properly draped in weaponized terminology. Equity, for example, has taken on special properties. If a person opposes an equity proposal, those advancing the proposal are secure in asserting that the person is motivated by opposition to racial equity itself. In other words, they are racist. My opposition to that first equity proposal was voiced to my colleagues with no students present. Demands for my resignation 1 year later, in May of 2017, were not the result of organic student confusion. They were payback for violating a de facto code of faculty conduct in which one's right to speak is now dictated by adherence to an ascendant orthodoxy in which one's race, gender, and sexual orientation are paramount. The students were on a mission. They were unwitting tools of a witting movement. This committee should take my tale as cautionary. Is there a free speech crisis on college campuses? One can certainly make that argument, but that portrayal is at least as misleading as it is informative. What is occurring on college campuses is about power and control. Speech is impeded as a last resort, used when people or groups fail to self-censor in response to a threat of crippling stigma and the destruction of their capacity to earn. These tools are being used to unhook the values that bind us together as a nation: equal protection under the law, the presumption of innocence, a free marketplace of ideas, the concept that people should be judged by the content of their character rather than the color of their skin. Yes, even that core tenet of the civil rights movement is being dismantled. Am I alleging a conspiracy? No. What I have seen functions much more like a cult, in which the purpose is only understood by the leaders, and the rest have been seduced into a carefully architected fiction. Most of the people involved in this movement earnestly believe that they are acting nobly to end oppression. Only the leaders understand that the true goal is to turn the tables of oppression. Something is seriously and dangerously amiss. At this moment in history, the center does not hold. Partisan polarization and political corruption have rendered government ineffective, predatory, and often cruelly indifferent to the suffering of American citizens. Tribalism is the natural result. Evergreen's public meltdown placed me in the eye of the storm and cast me into the spotlight. As a member of the intellectual dark web, I find myself at the vanguard of an emerging, non-ideological, non-partisan movement. Along with the Heterodox Academy and the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education, we are fighting to restore civility and respect for competing perspectives. The electorate is starved for honest debate and for the good governance that follows from it. My advice to this body is to put the nation and its core values ahead of partisanship and join us in the center to end this cultish power grab and return us to a forward path as a nation. I look forward to your questions.
What has been the reaction to what happened to you, both on campus and off campus? Have any changes been made?
The campus has doubled down on every foolish idea it was pursuing and has gotten itself into very serious financial trouble for lack of students, which I should tell you, I warned my colleagues that if they pursued this false equity proposal, that would be the result. So a rather predictable disaster is occurring on campus. I do want to push back a little bit, though, on the assessment that it is the left, because really it isn't one left. There is an ascendant orthodoxy on the left that is very troubling. It is quite broad, but I think not very deep. Then there's a concentrated mirror image of that on the far right, and both of these things are to be feared. The problem, though, is when you speak out on a college campus from a perspective on the left that does not fit this orthodoxy, you are immediately categorized as on the right, which makes it look that the left is monolithic and all shares this opinion, but it's not the case.
Dr. Weinstein, what happened in your classroom, which I've
down.
Seen videos of?
Was bring this down. Thank you. Okay, there are three different perspectives on our educational system. If you've been fortunate, as I have, to have gone through an educational system without this type of conflict, but with vigorous debate and with a debate where you are respectful of the person you're debating and you're making your best arguments, that's healthy. We need debate. We need dialogue. We do not need censorship, and that's what we have. Even on Pacifica, there are no rooms for debate based upon ideology. I'll give you just one example. Bonnie Faulkner, a highly respected journalist and broadcaster, wanted to do a discussion on the science behind vaccines when California was mandating vaccines and was about to take a vote. Being a strong voice in the Bay Area, where you have a large intelligentsia, a lot of professional class, it may have made the difference. We will never know. But we were told we could not do the debate. Why? Because the people at the station didn't want to hear from anyone who held a position to challenge the safety or efficacy of vaccines. Now, I'm a scientist. I have to be conscious of what I say. Also, a lot of people throughout my career, which is over 51 years, have used my books, documentaries, lectures, health support groups, and daily broadcasts and articles as something that they can trust. Knowing that, we have gone to great lengths, even hiring scholars and residents to validate and verify everything. And if we can't validate it, we don't use it. So when you spend 15,000 hours of time on a topic, you really are committing an enormous amount of your intellectual thoughts to that. And you're weighing what is the evidence. And at the end, your decision of what to do and write and your conclusions are based upon the evidence in front of you. And our evidence clearly showed that though people should have the right to take vaccines, the state should not have the right to mandate them because they do not have the unequivocal science to support their safety. And as just one example, I collected over 1,000 articles, all from the peer-reviewed literature, just on one ingredient in vaccines, aluminum. And these were from highly respected peer-reviewed journals on toxicology. And every single one said it's a neurotoxin. It's toxic in any amount. That was just one of 80 ingredients you can find in various vaccines. And since many people get multiple vaccines at the same time, especially when they don't even have a developing immune system, it is absolutely insane. It is the height of science and medical folly to give a newborn baby, an hour after they've been born, hepatitis B vaccine. The child does not have an immune system. The child does not have hepatitis. When was the last time you heard a child being born with hepatitis, which is principally hepatitis B, which is sexually transmitted? All you had to do is do a serological test on the mother. The mother shows that she is non-carrier. Then if she was, you could test the baby. But they don't do that. It's all about money, it's all about power, and it's all about profit. And they're indemnified. If your baby dies, too bad. And what happens if the baby dies a week later from home? You could be charged with shaken baby syndrome. They never accept responsibility for the mistakes they've made on millions of children that have affected them in various spectrum disorders, like autism spectrum disorder. I was not allowed to present that information on a station that prides itself, KPFA in Berkeley, as free speech. There's nothing free about the speech there. From top to bottom, It is an ideological, radicalized station. That's its right. Its listeners want that, or they would abandon it. But it barely survives, as all the stations do, in no small measure because they've not chosen the needs of the audience, but rather their own specific soapboxes to get up and chant their own slogans. He was right. It's more of a cult. So what happens when we're denied our freedom to speak, when people do not want us to speak? Now, coming from the liberal and then progressive perspective, I'm dismayed and disheartened by how many of the corporate liberals, that mainly Democrats, who show nothing in common with the historical and true liberals, have taken over the movements. And that is a danger to all of us, because you're not going to get objective insights and information. They all make promises what they're going to change. Nothing changes. I'd like to hear your point of view. If you have a point of view, you have an opportunity now to share it. You can call 888-874-4888. We're going to take a brief break, and when we come back, if we have calls, we'll go to them. If we don't, we'll go to the next section of our program. Okay, I'm looking here whether or not we have some callers coming in. And let's see here. I'm taking a look. Do we have any callers? Nope, unfortunately we do not. Okay, well, I wanted you to call in. Let me share a few thoughts of my own. I always like to hold my thoughts until the audience has shared their perspective. But since, for whatever reason, and we have a large audience, this is surprising, because if I asked people to talk about their health problems, we would have 20,000 calls. First, to the teacher. Here's what I would say about the teacher. I have enormous sympathy for her predicament, the stress that she's under that she called post-traumatic stress disorder, and she couldn't wait another year. I believe that in that situation, you're not going to be able to save that school. Why? Because the children do not exist in a vacuum. When the gangs and the students who don't want to be there, the truant students, when they take over, run the hallways, seek fights, assault teachers with impunity, sexually expose, grope, and attack teachers, the system is broken down. If you think it's going to be corrected by putting some police in there, you're wrong, because the students are not coming to learn at that point. It is too far gone. And who's not being held accountable? The parents. We have a problem asking the parents, how did your children get to be at this level? Because we're not paying attention to the quality of life and surroundings and environment of the parent. Now, if you're a really good parent and you know what a child needs and you're able to provide that, there is a high probability, even given peer pressure, that the student will not act out and get an education, because every day students who come from broken families still exceed the limitations of their environment and circumstances because they want the education. They want to get out of that environment. They want to get new friends that are healthy and happy and positive. They don't want the gangbangers. They don't want the people who survive in the lower level of human ethics and morality. There's also those students who, given the right input, will carry that forward, as many of us did. Now, I had a discussion today about this, where someone wanted to blame my generation, and we deserve blame, because our parents were the ones who created this mess we're in because they imparted wrong values or no values in us. And I told this person, I take a completely different position. I believe you're absolutely on the opposite side of this. I said, there's no generation in American history that had better parenting skills, sacrificed more for their children than the greatest generation, those born in the early 1900s and up through the Great Depression. I said, we benefited from the fact that they made 16 years of extreme sacrifice. They went through the Great Depression and then World War II. Many of them had coupon books and they had ration books. There was only so much gasoline or so much food that they could purchase based upon what they were given. And still, you could have people that instilled in others, no matter how bad it is now, there'll be a better day. Let's stay together. Keep our character. So from 1945 up through the mid-70s, in that 30-year period, about 35 years, the American middle class became a formidable platform for the best of education. You could walk into almost any community in America without fear. There was jobs, there were unions, there was collective bargaining, there were rights, there was the civil rights movement, the women's rights movement, the human rights movement, there was back to the farm movement. All these wonderful movements emerged and evolved because of our parents. We then took advantage of that. The fact that many in my generation chose not to listen, not to learn, to forget what our parents had sacrificed to themselves so we didn't have to. So in many respects, our parents lived through crisis that they did not want us to experience. And since we didn't have that experience, we just took it for granted that whatever we wanted to do, we could. There were three jobs awaiting for every person graduating from college. So we could be selective. We didn't have debt. We didn't have credit cards. We didn't have distractions. You went to school. You went to school to learn. If you acted up, you were warned, then you were thrown out. There was a consequence to bad behavior. There was a positive consequence to good behavior. We respected our elders. There was no one left behind. People had extended families. The older you became, the more important you became in the family. You could go to any city park on a Sunday and see people have picnics and all generations represented. Everybody was a part of that. In no small measure, that came because of all the immigrants from other countries who grew up with deep respect and reverence for those who were older. We didn't have a problem at one level that we have today because people were not uncertain about who they were, their essential meaning to life. They were very confident in who they were as individuals, what role they could play in a society, and they didn't fear death because they didn't fear life. We have a whole generation today that are clueless about who they are, with some exceptions. They're depressed or anxious. They find constant desire to distract themselves from the moment they're in. There is no sense of mastery, of discipline, of appreciation, of empathy. And yet we're supposed to believe that these people are going out and change the world for the better. They're going to lead an environmental movement when they can't even get off their hamburgers to go to a plant-based diet. That they're going to help people in other countries when they don't care about people in their own country who are going hungry or homeless. So could you imagine them having any empathy for the people in Yemen or other crisis areas around the world where 29 people are at risk of dying because of starvation and the elements of war? We have people who say they want to be contributing to the body politic because they don't like the existing system, yet they wouldn't vote for Ralph Nader, Rocky Anderson, Jill Stein, people who could have and would have made a difference because they were more enlightened and more humanistic. So what exactly have we created today? We've created generations of people who become parents who really are not prepared to be parents. And therefore, they end up with, they have parent deficit disorder, a condition where people are not ready to be mature enough and to be responsible for other people's lives. We have the careerist, and careerists generally have two kids in a family. They'll give the kid private schools, they'll give the kid everything the kid materially needs. But the kid was not born with the material needs of the parent, but rather the emotional needs, and that's a problem. So that's what we're dealing with, and that's an issue. The lack of good parenting skills has led to children who do not have the grounding in moral, social issues. They just don't know how to relate the consequences of their actions to other people. they're indifferent. So that's a person that if they get out of that environment are likely to go into a job where they're not going to care too. And think of Wall Street. Think of the business community. Think of the hedge funds and equity partners. Think of all the people who make money off payday loans and credit card interest rates when a person cannot afford a full payment on their interest, and therefore their interest doubles. So we have predatory lending, vulture capitalism, and this is our professional class. That's almost 68 million people, including children. Do you really think that the majority, there will always be exceptions, but the majority of the professional class, lawyers, doctors, engineers, professors, the hedge fund owners, do you think these people are going to have a group of children that they raise who will learn austerity and humility and will go to public schools and go in and use the skills they have and the resources they have to help the poor, the needy? No. The vast majority are so self-indulgent that even owning 20 Louis Vuitton bags at $20,000 each is still not enough for them to feel good about themselves because their parents are always seeking more. More of something, that vapid ether that they breathe that is supposed to make them feel better because of their standing in their community. So everything is about their standing. Their insecurity is the foundation upon which they rest. How do you think their kids are going to act? They won't be joining gangbangers, but they'll be joining a far more lethal group of people on Wall Street or industrialized America or in the media where they can use the power they have in their own hegemonic way over other people or groups. That is a danger. Then you take your millionaire class, they're even more spoiled because their kids feel absolutely entitled because their parents are really rich. And so everything is about where they went to private school, how much their parents spend on them, who got the most expensive car when they were able to drive. Nothing about what they can do with their resources to help others. So be honest for a moment. You have one-third of the American population, but 95% of all policymakers and opinion leaders, the people that actually cause policy and implement it, and they're all co-opted by a lack of moral balance in their lives and lack of spiritual consideration. So exactly how are these people supposed to care about schools, public or private, school teachers, or identity politics? In the world they live in, they can always melt behind a gated wall. And the rest of the people cannot get in. They go to places and live in areas that they seem to be immune. So you must consider that, and the parents must be also held accountable for the actions of the children. Until we can do that as a nation, instead of filling this enormous guilt complex, in which case we give all of our attention to those who are least likely to do anything with it, and no attention to those who are acting appropriately and caring, then we're not going to change anything. Those are my thoughts. Again, I would like to hear yours, but that means you got to call in. I believe we have a caller, James from New York. James, you're on the air.
Oh, good afternoon, Gary. Gary, what you said right there is a problem here, right here in the city of New York, where the public school system has been invaded by the charter schools. And one school I went to, which was a junior high, and then they turned it into a high school. And then when it came down to funding, the charter school in the school got extra money to educate those students. And meanwhile, those that are under the public school system got less money. And the issue was that, well, if the school is going to be completely chartered, then get rid of the public school and make it sort of semi-private. But the parents got together and they said, enough is enough. You're not going to turn this place into a private, upty school. We're going to turn the school to the community and let the students learn. So we had to fight tooth and nail with the city hall as well as the state to keep that school open because that was the only school in the neighborhood that the school even had facilities to learn. But the teachers or even told, well, if you don't want to teach here, you can go and play someplace else. We'll bring teachers in here and pay them less than what they're paying the public school students. So what you're saying there is a problem because many communities support the schools, but the schools have been jaded with a lot of politics from the government. Various politicians feel that, well, this school should be a private school. We can put money in there and get the kind of students we want. And they forget about the parents completely. And what you're saying there about the family in this country is being destroyed completely. The mother and father is no more. It's more of an institution, family, and that is destroying the entire country.
I appreciate your input. I've been asked on several occasions to lecture in schools. I have, including charter schools. The charter school has an advantage. It's not a nonprofit operation. It's a for-profit operation. Here is the problem. The money was taken from the public schools, frequently funneled into the charter schools. Now, the charter schools have not been able to academically produce better outcomes for their students, and that's been shown time and again. Many charter schools have had to shutter. I visited a charter school in Newark, New Jersey. It was a wonderful school, and the person who ran the school, who founded the school, really cared about creating critical thinkers. In fact, she had invited me to put them all on a health program and then come back a half year later to see the results. What amazed me was how their parents had made major changes in their own health. All the kids, by the way, were minority students, Latino and African American. Their parents, who had diabetes, were obese, had high blood pressure. I'm talking about major changes, all because their kids knew the truth. They were reading nutrition books. They were learning how to cook. I did cooking classes for them and juicing classes. And they applied that. They applied it directly to their parents with results that you'd have been in tears had you sat there on that final evening when I came to show the reason. And the reason they had that whole school, attended, hundreds of kids, with their parents to show the results of what happened. I did it twice with the same outcome in two different charter schools. The kids wore their uniforms. They were well-mannered. They didn't have all the fights. They didn't have the gangbangs. They didn't have the drugs. They had a sense of hope. I wanted to see that hope in public schools because I grew up going to public schools, and I wanted to support the public schools. Then you start seeing how much money is spent in public schools, and the amount of money spent in public schools is very high. In fact, some of the poorest neighborhoods in America are spending the most. And then you say, well, how is it possible you could be putting that much money, over $10,000 per year per student, and have such terrible outcomes? I've been in the schools where you don't have textbooks, where you don't have working computers to all the kids, where windows are broken and desks, and it's filthy and dirty. They don't have proper janitorial services. And it's because it's not going into the classroom. It's not helping the students. It's in administration. There's a whole phenomenon now in higher education where the student is secondary importance. It's how much money they can wring out of the government, state or federal, or private corporations or foundations, to get that money into the hands of those who can hire administrators. And the administrators are running everything, and they're taking the lion's share of that money. And that's unfortunate, because if we spend more money, there won't be more money going in the classroom. There won't be an improvement. This woman talked about having better teachers. We have outstanding teachers in America. Teachers and their qualifications and their desire to teach are not the problem. But we also have more teachers now retiring before their time is up because they can't take the environment. We have to rethink the privatization of our educational system. This current Secretary of Education, Betty DeVos, she's a billionaire. She is an extraordinarily intellectually limited person. She doesn't even understand the educational system. She never had to teach. For those of us who have taught and understand the system and its politics and the corruption of many of its union leaders, then you think, wow, how can we correct a system when so many of the supporting components of that system are themselves wrong? And the final reality is, you're not going to be able to. At some point, we're going to have to be honest about how bad the system is and redo it all. Otherwise, we're going to have more of the problems we saw and you've seen. Thank you very much for your call. We're out of time, everyone. Thank you all for listening to this special edition of the Progressive Commentary Hour. Have a nice day.
Hey, what's happening?
Brother, what's up?
This is a big party, man.
Yeah, brother, like,
dig it.
Stop right on.